just after the 1 o'clock news. But now, at 12 midday, it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Marina Levitska spent decades as an unpublished writer, a bit like being an asylum seeker, she says. But for the last 5 years, she's been a hugely successful novelist. The first book, which really took off, had the catchy title A Short History of Tractors in Ukrainian. It's been much garlanded. And then, following that, we had Two Caravans, a hilarious but very touching book. And now we are all made of glue. And once again, in this book, it seems to me, Marina, there's this feeling of observing how we all try to cope with adversity one way or another, and yet it nearly always comes back and hits us in the face. And it's a wry look at how people deal with the events that unfold in most people's lives, I suppose.
It is about adversity, but what I feel about my books is that the characters have got a tragic destiny mapped out for them, but they refuse it. And they go out and look for happiness and look for joy, almost in spite of the things which are lying there in wait for them. And so in all of my books, in a way, I think it started with my parents, who could and should have had a terrible fate, but somehow managed to dodge and escape it and ended up living happily in England. And in my second book, looking at migrant workers, I didn't want to talk only about the misery and exploitation, though there are plenty of those. I actually wanted to tell a story of people who survive and who make a bit of money and who fall in love and who have a bit of fun. And there are terrible things that happen, but life isn't all like that. And so with We're All Made of Glue also, I tried to have an old lady who's really had a terribly hard and tragic life, as indeed have her family. And yet, in spite of that, has been somebody who seized life for herself and tried to wring the last little bit of pleasure and fun out of it.
Well, I do think they're life-affirming, your books, and largely because you've got such a wonderful sense of humour. I mean, they're very funny.
Thank you. I think humour is one of the things which sees... Well, it's one of the things about being human, isn't it? It's almost a sort of essential part of the human condition. It sees us through the really hard times.
Now, in each of your books, there are references to, and funny and endearing ones, to, well, cats, dog, but music too.
Yes, and especially in the latest one, actually, because in a way, music is one of those things which travels with people. And because my books are books about migrants and migration, people often bring their music with them as well as their stories. So my parents brought their music from Ukraine. And my father in particular was very fond of Russian music, and that's a thread through the book. Mrs. Shapiro's husband is actually a musician. In a way, their bond was through music, and the bond that she makes with the narrator is when she finds that the narrator has actually thrown out her husband's music onto the skip.
Yes, Shostakovich, Mussorgsky.
That's right, yes, which would have been the music that her husband grew up with.
It's not any of the Russians that we're going to begin with, but it is the first piece of music you more or less fell in love with, I think.
I was very young, yes. I must have been maybe about 8 or 9. And we lived in quite a sort of miserable little town called Gainsborough in Lincolnshire. It was rather dull little semis, a very cramped, constricted provincial life. And I can't exactly remember where I heard this piece of music. It must have either been in somebody's house or maybe even through an open window, or maybe it was at school. But I can just remember being seized with absolute joy at the colour and the vividness and the sort of babble of voices from the different instruments.
Thank you. kind of joyous rightness about the music, as everything fits, and yet it has such bounce and elan.
It was like overhearing a conversation I couldn't quite understand, but really wanted to be part of.
When you started listening to music, did you feel this was something that would always be important to you, and did you start looking at more music?
Well, I think at that time, I probably didn't have very many opportunities. My parents, we were quite poor, and I wouldn't say that I had a deprived childhood, because I think in a lot of ways I had a very privileged childhood. But I think it wasn't until probably I was about 9 or 10, around about this time, that my father actually bought a record player and started to play records. And so I did listen to music at home. There weren't concerts in Gainsborough, or if there were, I didn't know about them. But the music that one heard was either in church or, in fact, in school. You know, I went to the local grammar school. We had a school orchestra. We had a school choir. And those were my first experiences of live music. And again, it was very exciting, that the possibility that one would listen to music, but also that it was something that you could do, that it was a way of expressing joy and creativity and childishness and even play, that again, in this sort of drab, very constrained little world, was just like flinging a door open.
Well, we heard the first movement of the Bach Brandenburg Concerto No. 1 in F, BWV 1046, the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, directed by Neville Marriner. I think one of the pieces that you first fell in love with during those early sort of formative days at school comes from much the same period as the Bach, slightly removed, but by the other great figure, really, Handel.
Mm. Yes, I think probably for me and for a lot of people, Handel's Messiah is their first experience of live music, because outside of London, outside of the big cities, usually there'll be a church or a choir or somebody will put it on at Christmas. And that's how it came to me. And I can remember struggling with being the second violin in the school orchestra. I hadn't been at it very long and I wasn't very good. But actually, I was so moved and touched by the cooperative nature of making a piece of music like that. Everybody sort of working together, and then the moments of brilliance, and the people who'd been our teachers and who'd been boring and seen us through these dull classes and geography lessons and history lessons and classics, suddenly acquired these extra qualities that they could sing this really marvellous stuff. And the piece I chose is I Know That My Redeemer Liveth, because what I remember is the beauty of it, but also there's the incredible fragility of the voice and the uncertainty, that the possibility of failure is always there, the possibility that they won't quite hit that high note. And when they do, the relief is so fabulous.
Thank you.
There's a wonderful poem by D.H. Lawrence that goes, "Softly in the dusk, a woman is singing to me, taking me back down the vista of years." And it's about him as a child sitting under the piano as his mother was playing and singing. And it's, it reminds me so much of that piece of music, because it's about the way that music draws in memories and intertwines the present with the past so skillfully that it's not just the events that you remember, but the actual emotions that you felt. So Lawrence remembers the emotions he felt as a child when he hears his mother playing the piano. And I often think of that when I listen to that piece of music. I can so remember what it felt like to be a child and to have the sort of muddy, dirty, dismal, everyday school life just suddenly transformed into this magic.
I know that my Redeemer liveth from part three of The Messiah. Carolyn Sampson was the soprano with The 16, directed by Harry Christophers. Marina Levitsky, you went, as I said earlier, through a long period of being unpublished. And I wonder whether, when you look back, are there amongst those manuscripts things that are now you'd like to salvage?
When I look back on my years as an unpublished writer, there are bits and pieces I'd like to salvage. But on the whole, there are ideas, maybe, and there are characters. But those stories belong to a different time. And I feel that I've learned such a lot now about what not to do as well as to do. I'm sorry to say this, but the people who rejected them so many times, they were right.
The next piece, really, I suppose, is very much a memorial to your father.
It is. It's an homage to my father, really, who he died 2 years ago, but he donated his body to medical science and they've just released it for cremation. And I've been going through his papers and I found a list of his favourite music. And I noticed that he's got Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique, which is one of my chosen pieces, and also the Sibelius Violin Concerto. And I can remember him playing that. I remember when he brought it home. And he had a passion for photography. He had an old plate glass, silver nitrate coated camera, and used to go out and take pictures of trees. And he would blow up, enlarge the pictures of the trees and actually use them as covers for his favourite records. And I remember that the one he chose for the violin concerto by Sibelius was some very tormented looking cedar trees. And so whenever I hear this music, I think of those cedar trees. And also I think of my father. And also I just think it's a most wonderful piece of music.
Thank you. the opening of the Sibelius Violin Concerto in D minor, Opus 47. We heard David Oistrakh, the solo violinist with the Moscow Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Gennady Rozhdestvensky. That is music that actually also has a kind of feeling of landscape anyway, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yes, very much so. And cold, you can almost feel the cold, and especially at the beginning, it almost starts with the wind blowing, a dusting of snow across the landscape, doesn't it? And for me, I always see the cedar trees sort of bowing under the wind when the violins get going.
Do you ever feel, Marina Levitska, any kind of kinship or particular feeling for the country where you were born? Because, of course, you moved here a year later, so you could hardly have known.
No, I was actually born in Germany. I don't know Ukraine at all, except that after my first book was published, I went back, and maybe we'll talk a bit about that when we come on to one of my later choices. But growing up in England, I think the English landscape is a very big influence on all of my writing, in a way. Being able to describe it in words, not just the appearance of it, but the smells and the sounds and the texture of the air is something which it's so interesting to try and do, even if you never quite pull it off. It's so worthwhile to try, I think. I felt it also about the Sibelius piece. You know, it reminds me of my 50 years as an unpublished writer, because I was trying to learn to play the violin when I first heard that music. And I realised that actually, even if I carried on practising for 50 years, I was a lost cause. And so I decided to move on from there and have a go at learning the piano.
And how do you get on with that?
Not terribly well either, but much better than the violin, because actually, you really have to have perfect pitch to play the violin, and I haven't. Whereas with the piano, as long as your piano's in tune and you're reasonably dexterous, you can sort of manage.
And this is a piece, I think, that you do attempt.
The next piece is a piece that I do attempt, but also it's the piece which is absolutely at the limit of my ability, and it's the piece that I've never mastered, and that's why I love it, because I go back to it again and again and again. And there are trills in it which are so fast, I actually can't hear, I can't disentangle them. And I feel so overawed by Mozart's capacity to imagine this sort of range of emotions and encapsulate them in a form that is so strange and so difficult for me. As I say, I come back to it again and again.
Thank you. performance you approve of?
Oh, I think it's fabulous. Yes, I think that's probably the piece of music which made me give up my pretensions to be a pianist, as the Sibelius gave up my pretensions to be a violinist.
Curiously enough, Maria Jaupiras, who was playing there, looks very slightly like you, so it was rather appropriate. You should have had a...
Yes, I like the pauses and the silences. She really did that very well. It's the non-playing as well as the playing which makes it so good.
The Piano Sonata in F, Kirkel 332, of which that was the first movement, the Allegro, by Mozart. Silence is something which is very important in your new book, We're All Made of Glue. I mean, inasmuch as when a husband leaves a wife, the reverberance of things in the space that is left is very marked, isn't it?
Yes, the quality of silence is something that Georgie, the narrator, is very aware of when she walks around in the empty house. And it's one of the, you know, they have these wooden floors and nothing on the walls. And she hears the echoing and the clatter of the cutlery on the plate. And it very much intensifies her feeling of aloneness. And I think silence is such an interesting thing. We don't get enough of it. We don't get to listen to it often enough in the modern world. Although I love music, I get more and more drawn to silence and the sounds just at the edges and beyond silence, you know, the distant sounds with a close silence, I think are so interesting and have really become a very important part of my listening now. Because when you're trying to set a scene, one of the things that you do is imagine yourself in that space and imagine what would you hear. And often, first of all, you hear the silence and then you hear the little noises around. And that really brings home the sense of space, the sense of place, and the quality of the air, the echo, the size of the room that you're in, or if you're out of doors. All of those things are very important.
With the next music, Marina Levitska, there's a marvellous narrative going on. And did that influence you at all in your choice?
Yes, I think after I'd given up thinking that I would ever be a musician, this was a piece of music that came to me as a gift, really, because it was a piece of music that told a story, or it seemed to tell a story. And certainly it took the listener through a sort of range of emotions and experiences, very much as a writer tries to do. And I was so impressed by Berlioz's skill and ingenuity and willingness to play with different sorts of sounds, and bring them into this fabulous composition. I can't remember which movement I chose. Was it
the March to the Scaffold?
Good. Thank you.
That has real menace in it, doesn't it?
Doesn't it just? Yes, it's very much a storyteller's piece of music, because sometimes when I'm writing and I don't know exactly what it is, I don't know how to create a mood. Listening to a piece of music, especially something like that, you think, that's exactly the atmosphere that I'm aiming for. And the thing that I so envy musicians and composers is that they don't have to worry about the words and the story. They only have to have the atmosphere and the emotion. I don't know how it is that music can work like that, directly on the emotions, without having the intermediary of words and story. It seems like a miracle.
Well, is that why it's something that writers are, and other people in other disciplines are, intrigued by? Because you do not have the specificity.
I think that's it, yes. Yeah. It's intriguing. And as I say, it makes me so envious that one can access the emotions directly without having to go through the inventions of stories and characters and narratives, and that you can just simply, somehow through some power that certainly I don't understand, can just reach directly to the emotional hit.
The March to the Scaffold, the fourth movement of the Berlioz Symphonie Fantastique, Opus 14, the Boston Symphony Orchestra in that recording, conducted by Charles Münch. Well, let's carry on that conversation, because it applies to our next piece. And I imagine that, being a storyteller yourself, that opera is something which quite fascinates you, but maybe you've not been to it a lot. I mean, people seem to have very mixed feelings about opera. Where does it sit with you?
I grew up thinking that I would never be the sort of person who liked opera. I thought it was pompous and ridiculous and pretentious, and that the stories were stupid. And I quite like the music. I can't remember exactly what it is that brought the change about in me. But there was certainly, it's liking opera now belongs to my period as a writer. And what I get now from opera, and especially from Mozart, I have to say, is that amazing marriage of story and music, but also, and again, especially with Mozart, the ability to move from joy to sorrow, to joy to sorrow, to tragedy to comedy, you know, all within the same half hour.
Well, even actually within the same minute.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, as a writer, you can only sit back with envy and awe and think, you know, how do they do it? How do they do it? And very often I will listen to a piece of music, as with Berlioz, but most often with Mozart, because he's the composer who writes the kind of books that I'd like to write, who manages to move so seamlessly between tragedy and joy and gossip and, you know, a little bit of bitchiness here and there, and then, you know, sort of making you shed tears of pain next. And he can just move you through that range so seamlessly.
Well, especially in this opera.
This one in particular.
What made you choose Dove Sono?
I think that particularly is a piece of music which is so sad, and yet its beauty. And its beauty is so haunting that although the story is sad, you can't help but be uplifted by it.
Dove Sono from The Marriage of Figaro, Act 3 by Mozart. We heard Margaret Price singing there with the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by James Lockhart. We were talking earlier, Marina Levitska, about landscape, and there's a very amusing moment in Two Caravans where Andre, the strawberry picker from Ukraine, is taking his would-be girlfriend Irina to this most beautiful city in the world, Sheffield. And yes. Somehow he's got his wires crossed, and as they come over the hill, it begins to dawn on them that perhaps there's been a little bit of fantasy going on here. But of course, Sheffield is where you are based.
I've lived in Sheffield for almost 30 years now, and actually it's a wonderful city. It's also, I have to say, the home of the Lindsay Quartet, or was for a long time. And it is a place with music and theatre and art. Unlike places such as Doncaster and Gainsborough, where I grew up, where that was less available. It's a place which has been home to me for almost 30 years now.
But let's go back, as we promised we would then, to the place that might have been home, and in one sense, right at the start.
Yes, my parents talked to me a lot about Ukraine. They came from Ukraine, and my whole childhood was sort of threaded through with these stories of this place, which had an almost mythical quality, this land of wide horizons where the sky is blue and the cornfields are yellow and they ripple away, and there are birch trees and oaks and the clouds stand heavy in the sky. This was like the land of my childhood imagination. And so I always wanted to see it. And also, I was always a bit afraid because as an adult, of course, I realised that it would never be as I'd imagined it. But after my parents died, almost by chance, I made contact with my family in Ukraine and they invited me to visit. And going there, it was very moving because it was like stepping back into my childhood. And in a way, because sadly, Ukraine is so underdeveloped, certainly the rural parts are so underdeveloped, very little had changed. So we went back to the village where my parents had lived, and there was a well there outside the door which the family still used for drawing their water, which my father had dug before the war. So the landscape in many ways was very untouched and very beautiful, and also was, I always feel about that landscape, somehow it was soaked in blood and soaked in sorrow. So many people have died there. And the history of both Russia and Ukraine are so heavy with tragedy and war and death. That comes out in the folk music as well, that all the music, even the joyful music, has a thread of sadness running through it.
Чорний ворон, що ж ти в'єшся, да над моєю головой, ты добычи не добьешься, черный ворон, я не твой. Субтитры сделал DimaTorzok. любушке моей, и ей скажи, она свободна. Я женился да на другой. Роковой. Вижу, смерть моя приходит, черный ворон, весь я твой. Вижу, смерть моя приходит, черный ворон, весь я твой.
Yes, there's tragedy etched into those lines, isn't there?
The черный ворон is the black raven which circles above the battlefield. And the song begins, the soldier is saying, I don't belong to you, go away. But in the end, he becomes a victim as well. It's a very simple song. It's an anti-war song, but it sort of, in some ways, encapsulates the very tragic spirit of the country that my parents came from.
Stella Zubkova sang that traditional Russian folk song, Black Raven, and I suppose it brings us full circle. It's rather nice to move finally, and perhaps we'll let it play us out from the Black Raven to the more optimistic Dawn Chorus, which is what I think you've chosen for your final bit of music.
Yes, the raven is a very sad and very portentous bird, but very often when I wake up in the morning, I wake up early enough to hear the dawn chorus, and I love to listen to it. And when I get the chance to start writing very early in the morning, I love to hear the birds sort of cheer me along as I get out my laptop and set to work.
Have you started on a new novel?
I have. I'm working on my fourth novel. It's very hard. I need a lot of dawn choruses to see me through it.
Well, thank you very much, Marina Levitska, and we'll leave you with your dawn chorus in the hope that you'll go home and be able to write out your next chapter.
Thank you.
Marina Levitska was talking to Michael Barclay. And next week, Michael's guest on Private Passions will be the actor Ian McDermid. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. Today's edition was produced by Chris Marshall.
Performance on 3 brings you another brilliant youth orchestra from Venezuela's highly successful programme El Sistema. The musicians of the Teresa Carreño Youth Orchestra are on their first international tour, and we're at their final date in London's Royal Festival Hall to hear them play Bernstein, Copland, Tchaikovsky and Chavez. The young players should give that programme plenty of Venezuelan fire and passion, conducted by a protégé of El Sistema, Christian Vasquez. Join us for tomorrow night's Performance on 3 from 7 here on BBC Radio 3.
We're close to the present at 2 o'clock this afternoon. Chichi Nwanaku introduces more of your requests. This week, a lively boat trip from Venice to Padua, set by the Renaissance Italian madrigalian Adriano Banchieri. Ian Bostridge sings Britain's folk song arrangements. There's a birthday tribute to Arvo Pärt. And a delicious masterpiece by French romantic Ernest Chausson. That's at 2 o'clock this afternoon. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's now 1 o'clock, time for the news read by John Shea.
3 days before the government announces its spending review, the Chancellor, George Osborne, has insisted that cuts are needed to restore credibility to the public finances. He said the country had been on the brink of bankruptcy when Labour left office. Mr Osborne also announced measures to tackle benefit fraud, saying people who made unreasonable mistakes on claim forms would face a £50 fine. Those who misclaimed three times would have their payments suspended for 3 years. The Shadow Chancellor, Alan Johnson, said the government should cut less and tax the banks more. Football's governing body, FIFA, is investigating claims that two of its officials offered to sell their votes in the ballot that decides who hosts the World Cup in 2018 and 2022. The Sunday Times said Amos Adamu of Nigeria and Reynald Temari of Tahiti told undercover reporters they would accept money for projects in their regions. Both have since said their votes can't be influenced. The charity Save the Children has said one of its workers who's been kidnapped in Somalia is well and in good spirits. The British worker was taken near the border with Ethiopia on Thursday. Save the Children said it was still extremely concerned and called on the man's captors to release him. 25 people were injured, two of them seriously, when a car was driven at a crowd of people outside a nightclub in Rochdale early this morning. Police said the club's doormen may have been the targets. No one's been arrested. At least 10 people have been killed in a crush at a Hindu festival in the northeastern Indian state of Bihar. At least 20,000 worshippers had gathered at the temple. A district official said the crush started after rumours that part of the temple had collapsed. The mathematician Benoit Mandelbrot has died aged 85 in the United States. His work in the 1970s led to a new branch of geometry known as fractals. He held French and US citizenship, but was born into a Jewish family in Poland before moving to Paris aged 11 to escape the Nazis. And the weather. It should stay bright and dry for most of the UK today. Temperatures will range from 12 to 14 degrees Celsius with some breeze. The news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at 1:02 past 1.
And it was read by John Shea. Well, now, here on Radio 3, today's early music show. Alessandro Scarlatti was born 350 years ago. And today's early music show celebrates his anniversary with a look back at the music the composer helped put on for a very special guest. Here's Catherine Bott.
Hello. In today's programme, music to set before a king. The year, 1702, the place, Naples, and the king in question, the 19-year-old Philip V of Spain, who'd come from his native France for a month and required the finest musicians to dance attendance on him. Musicians like Arcangelo Corelli and Alessandro Scarlatti.
Gravis, fatus, fatus es
Love, why have you become so harsh when I only ask for kindness? The aria Cur queso crudelis from Alessandro Scarlatti's amateur motet Infirmata Vulnerata, sung by David Daniels with the Arcadian Academy, directed by Nicholas McGeegan. Scarlatti wrote that in Naples in 1702, when he was 42 years old and just about to embark on a sabbatical. Or so he thought. After 18 years in the city, he had itchy feet and not nearly enough money to show for his service to the royal court there. He'd been lured from Rome by the promise of wonderful musical opportunities, particularly in the opera house. But he had a family to raise, and he was fed up with the quaint Neapolitan custom of paying as late as possible. So when he was granted leave of absence for 10 months, he started packing his bags for Florence and Rome. With him would go his 15-year-old son, Domenico, already a prodigy, already appointed organist and composer to the royal chapel. But before they could set out, the whole venture was cancelled. The new King of Spain was on his way, with a mission to put a lid on the simmering discontent which had followed the suppression of the anti-Spanish conspiracy initiated by Gaetano, Prince of Macchia. Just to put that into context, Naples, nowadays Italy's fourth city after Rome, Milan and Turin, Naples, the home of pizza. Well, 1702 was the 199th year of its being ruled by Spain. This regime had only a few more years to run, in fact, but no one could foresee that, as court and chapel alike scurried round preparing for the young king's arrival. More about him later, but first, a sonata by a violin virtuoso summoned from Rome to divert the royal party, Arcangelo Corelli.